It wasn't always like that. This week, as most of you know, marks the 66th anniversary of the creation of the State of Israel. This is not the time to explore what that means politically. Right now is not the time to explore even what that means religiously or halakhically. What it means practically is that we Jews today, Baruch Hashem, everyone sitting in this room, has the opportunity, like I said before, pretty much any time you want, to connect to Eretz Yisrael, to the land of Israel in a personal way, travel there, and so on and so forth. For that to happen, and for the State of Israel to have been created 66 years ago, many people, not much older than the students sitting in this room, than high school students in this room, lost their lives. And over the last 66 years, and anyone even remotely familiar with news knows that many times over the last 66 years, even recently, there are people living in Eretz Yisrael, your age, older and younger, who have lost their lives, whether through terrorism, through military operations, and other attacks. And so, a number of years ago, the government and the State of Israel established that there should be one day in the year where the Jewish community at large takes a short break, if you will, from whatever their other activities are, and ponders for a moment what it means to have a son, a daughter, a brother, a sister, a father, a mother, a spouse, taken away, sometimes in the prime of life, if not younger. And hence, the Yom HaZikaron, which is observed today, is a day where we should reflect on the debt that we personally, we don't realize it, but the debt that we personally, sitting in this room, owe to those who gave their lives in defense of Eretz Yisrael, so that we, like I said before, could go there and be there and spend time there whenever we want. And that's really the idea of Yom HaZikaron. And so for the next equivalent of a period or so, a little bit more, here in our yeshiva, we're getting together in this Beis Medrash. We'll hear from a couple of students. We'll share reflections that they've come up with on people who unfortunately did lose their lives. We'll hear from a guest speaker who himself fought in one of the most dangerous, if not the most dangerous of the Arab cities today. At the end there'll be a short video on Daven Mincha. I ask everybody, once again, I trust that everybody will approach this program with the appropriate dignity, with the appropriate seriousness, will do honor to the memories of those who have fallen, again, in defense of our land, and we'll have an opportunity to reflect for just a few moments upon what it means for us to have access to Eretz Yisrael and to remember those who gave their lives so that we can have that. program will begin. A couple of your schoolmates sharing some reflections that I hope you'll find meaningful. And again, I ask everybody, please, to give this program the appropriate attention, the appropriate dignity that it deserves. Thank you.
Gadi Ezra was a soldier in the IDF. His letter to his girlfriend, Galit, had been discovered in his bureau drawer soon after his death. It struck a chord in the Israeli public and received wide publicity. This is that letter. My beloved Galit, if this letter reaches you, it means that something has befallen me. This morning, I received word that the operation planned yesterday will take place, God willing. I told you that the operation had changed and that it was not what it was originally supposed to be because I didn't want to worry you, my dearest. It was very hard for me not to tell you the truth, but I preferred to do so rather than to drive you crazy with worry. One can tell a lie for peace, it is taught, and that also includes the peace of mind of the person that you love. My beloved, I feel that on the one hand there is nothing that I would like more than to be with you and to raise a family with you. But on the other hand, there's nothing that I want more than to go on this operation and deal such a great blow to the terrorists that they will never dare perpetrate another bombing or terror attack. That they will take into account that each time they commit an atrocity, we will hit them in the most painful place possible and will be willing to pay the price. I am willing to be that price. Do not be angry at me. In moments like this, one must be guided by the greater good of the people of Israel. And one needs to deal a blow to evil as if one has no private life. My dearest, do not forget, everything is for the best. And if this is what the Master of the Universe has chosen, so be it. To us remains the task of accepting it all with love. Everything the Lord does is for the best. Everything is for the best, even this. I promise you that I am in the most wonderful of places, without suffering, without regret. My only sorrow is for those who remain, for you, for my family, and for my friends. Spread the good news, my dearest one. Never despair, be only joyous. That is what I ask of you, even if it is difficult. I will love you to all eternities and will always be at your side.
Mourning a death, remembering inspiring life. Michael Levin was always smiling. You never saw Michael without a smile, said a member of Michael's circle of Jerusalem friends. We were all so close. Most of us here in Israel, alone, we live in Nachlaot. We bonded, became a family for each other. When this whole mess in Lebanon began, I worried about Michael. He was on active duty in the IDF. Then someone said he'd gone to visit family in Pennsylvania. And I was so relieved. At least I didn't have to worry about him. Next thing we knew, he'd cut his vacation short and rejoined his unit. It was something he had to do, he said. If I didn't come back to fight with my unit, I wouldn't have any life anyway. On Tuesday, August 1st, 2006, 2 days before Tisha B'Av, First Sergeant Michael Levin, age 22, died a hero's death. His unit, Battalion 890, had the task of clearing a building in southern Lebanese town. As they were setting up for defense in the building, a round of bullets from a Hezbollah heavy machine gunner entered through an opening in the building, hitting Michael and wounding two soldiers who were near him. Michael was killed instantly. His comrade Shlomi Singer, another Anglo-immigrant, tried to save him. It was very difficult, Singer said. We were under heavy fire, and all around us, our friends were wounded. 2 days later, on Tisha B'Av itself, Levin was laid to rest in Mount Herzl Cemetery. His family, mother, father, and two sisters flew in from Pennsylvania. They were joined by hundreds of people from all over Israel who came to pay tribute to the young hero. To speak of Michael's courage and strength of character seems almost superfluous. At age 18, he deliberately chose the hard, dirty, dangerous work of the IDF by coming to Israel to enlist in the IDF as a lone soldier. Officially, lone soldiers serve in the Machla unit, a Hebrew acronym for overseas volunteers. Native Israelis give the acronym a different twist. They say the letters stand for Meshuga'im Mechutz La'aretz, the crazy guys from outside Israel, who voluntarily enlist. Levin's crazy passion for Israel was ignited during his years at Camp Ramah. While many campers became enthusiastic Zionists, Michael was unique. He never let go of passion for Israel. His determination to not only live there, but to serve in the IDF, never wavered. Eitan Pir was Michael's shaliach, the Israeli immigration agent who processed Michael's application for Aliyah, said, "Michael just showed up at my office in New York, unannounced. He charmed his way in. In my entire career, I've only seen one other person so determined." Upon arrival in Israel, Michael wasn't about to tolerate the built-in delay that allows most new immigrants several months to settle in and adjust the Israeli way of life before starting IDF training. Michael fought for and received special permission to join the IDF almost right away. Once in, he fought again to get into the elite Sanchanim paratroopers brigade. Denied at first, he managed to climb through a second floor window by pushing a nearby dumpster alongside the building just to get inside in order to be able to get into the paratrooper brigade. He became one of the few former Americans to ever do so. He had to fight again against another disadvantage. He was so slightly built, so thin, that the first time he parachuted, he drifted off course. When Michael returned to Israel after cutting his family visit short in order to rejoin his unit, they tried to send him to Hebron, but again he fought. He wanted to serve with his unit in Lebanon. Was that brave? That word doesn't really fit Michael. He was more than brave. Michael wasn't a person who did brave things. Instead, courage was part of his character. Like his coming alone to Israel to enlist in the IDF. That wasn't brave, so much as it was a reflection of who he was. Our sages tell us that when a righteous person leaves this world, his presence can be felt more strongly in all the worlds than it was during his lifetime. Freed from his physical body, his influence will be even greater. Michael himself may have understood that. He and a friend from a kibbutz were once talking, lamenting the many losses Israel has suffered. "Why is it that all the good ones, the strong ones, die first?" his friend asked. Michael thought a moment, then said, "Maybe the real war is up there, and God needs them there." Rest in peace, Michael Levin. You fought the good fight. You gave your best every time. The true judge, Hashem, has called you home to continue your work from another plane. May all who knew you and all who met you only through your story be blessed by your courage, your love of life, and your passion for Israel and the Jewish people. Michael, we'll never forget your smile. And with your help, we'll continue working to accomplish all the things you wanted for your beloved homeland and the Jewish people.
Rabbi Ethan Katz served in the IDF as a master surgeon in the Israeli paratrooper brigade for 20 years. He fought in the Lebanon War as well as in the Jenin battles following the Seder massacre. Rabbi Katz currently serves as a regional director of New Jersey NCSY. He speaks in schools and communities throughout the New York area about pride and values that define SAHO. It's an honor for us to have him join us today.
Thank you.
Okay.
364 days out of the year, I try to lead my life the way a firm Jew should, humble, a little bit modest. Those people who know me keep saying, "Tell us an army story, tell us an army story," and I avoid it like the plague. One day a year, I figure this is my time to actually speak. When I was 8 years old, a lot younger than you guys are today, I was living in Israel. Yom Kippur of 1973, the first time I ever saw a car move on Yom Kippur, as Yom Kippur War was about to break out. I was sitting outside the shul with my friends, two of them, listening to the army radio on Yom Kippur, and our job was to listen to the secret call-up codes and to go in and tell the gabbai what they were. And I still remember them to this day. Sod Kodashim, Adma Betula, Beit HaSefer. It would go into the shul, tell the gabbai Dovet Tzal Modia, the army radio, announces Sod Kodashim. And he announced, it doesn't matter if it was in the middle of Kedusha, it doesn't matter if it was in the middle of anything else. Here we go. A few men would fold the taluses and go off to war. By the time the Ela came around, the only people left in shul were hysterical women, people under 18 and over 55. And I knew then that one day I would be that one who would have to leave shul in the middle and go fight for my country. In the following days, my father was also called up, and our house did not have a bomb shelter. So whenever the siren would go off that meant enemy MiGs, Syrian MiGs, are approaching, we'd have to run to the nearest bomb shelter, which meant going through a little forest, down a ditch, up a ditch, and across the street to the public bomb shelter. I was the youngest of four boys, and I was eight, and we had a rotation. Three of us would run as fast as we can to safety, and one of us would help my elderly mother, she was 30, you know, down the ditch and up. We couldn't leave her behind. We understood then what it meant to be an Israeli Jew. Moving back to the States, went to Chafetz Chaim Yeshiva in Los Angeles. One of my teachers wrote in my yearbook, I know you're going to go far, like the Syrian-Lebanese border. I don't know if he meant it as a joke or not, but before my 20th birthday, I didn't make it to the Syrian border, but I was deep in the heart of Lebanon in the first Lebanon War. I want to tell you that Yom HaZikaron in Israel is very, very different than it is here. As a religious soldier, we say, Yom HaZikaron She'avad, Yom HaZikaron Hazeh, Yom HaZikaron Hazeh, Yom HaZikaron Haba. We thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu that our name has now been added to the terrible list from last Yom HaZikaron to this Yom HaZikaron, and we pray that nobody's name will be added from this Yom HaZikaron to the next Yom HaZikaron. On channel 33, for those of us who have TVs, they have a listing of every single name of every soldier who gave his life for establishing the country and defending it. And we stay up late at night watching the names go by, and we remember friends, family, brothers in arms, we remember the battles. And one of the saddest things is that every year, the names appear on the screen for a split second list, as more and more names get added to that list every year. That's what Yom HaZikaron is like in Israel. Nobody's on their cell phones, nobody's partying, no one's doing Facebooks. If you're in touch with your friends in Israel, it's a very, very different atmosphere. Yom HaZikaron is commemorated in Israel the way Tisha B'Av is supposed to be commemorated worldwide. It's a day of mourning. It's a day of no social activity. Coffee shops and restaurants are closed. Movie theaters are closed. And nobody in their right mind will be caught listening to happy music. They'd be too embarrassed to even think about such a thing. I want to tell you two stories, one of which is mine, and one of which belongs to my nephew. My nephew is part of Hezder in the Gush, part of the 101 Sanhanim, the elite paratroopers division. Actually, my family's a bit of a mixed marriage. My oldest nephew is part of the 101. My second nephew is part of the 202 paratroopers division. My son joined the 101. I was part of Gdut Chamishim, the Nacha Mutznach. And my niece married out. She married a top commanding officer in an elite commander brigade called Yahalom, which means diamond. He's not a paratrooper, but he makes the rest of us look like nobodies, considering what he's done. His job is to blow things up behind enemy lines. When I once asked him how far he's been to Iran, he just smiled. So my nephew told us a story of his commanding officer, a young man by the name of Ilan Gabay from Haifa. He said, Ilan grew up in Haifa, in the Tzofim, in the Boy Scouts, probably never met a religious Jew in his life, certainly never had a conversation with one. And he was fascinated by this whole concept of Hezder guys, of people who know how to learn Torah and know how to fight. He never met such a group of people. And he wrote a letter to his good friend Yiftach Schreier, who he grew up with, and said, you gotta come and see this. He goes, these guys fight like the kibbutznikim of old. He goes, they're real factory. He goes, they're top line warriors. He goes, and they learn Torah whenever they're not training. because I've never seen anything like this in my life, because they're the most dedicated, motivated people you ever wanted to meet. Yiftach said, I got to see this, and he asked to be transferred and became a commanding officer in my nephew's unit. He was a very strange officer, Yiftach. He went once to do a home visit, and only officers do that when it's to give bad news. It was the son of the Rosh Hashiva of Chorev. And he went in and he said, I know this is very strange, but I was wondering if I could come and schmooze with you guys. And they said, sure, it's a little bit strange. And he started asking questions about Torah, about their beliefs. And he goes, can I see your son's room? And they said, okay. He goes, can I look through his holy books? And they said, sure. And the father said, like, what are you doing? You're an officer in the Israeli army, what are you doing? So he goes, I don't understand your son, and I don't understand his friends. I don't get it. Because I don't know what makes these guys tick. I know they tick better than anybody else, but I don't understand the Hesder unit mentality. He goes, and I fear that in the near future, I'm going to be leading them into battle. And I have to bring them home alive, back to you. He goes, I don't know what motivates them. He goes, I don't know how to manage them. He goes, so I want to learn everything I possibly can about your kids. And his father said to him, he goes, you're an officer, you're not an educator. And Yiftach responded with a line, which is now in officer's training school. He said, Mishe lo yadeh lechanech, shalei yimfaked batzal. Whoever does not know how to educate should not be a commander in the Israeli army. And the day came with the second Lebanon war breaking out. And Yiftach stood in front of his men. And he said, my fellow warriors, it has been deemed that we are going into Lebanon. We're going to be the first unit to go to fight for whatever we believe in. For God, if you believe in him, for our country, for our families. We're well trained for this mission. We're well prepared to carry it out, and we will succeed in this mission. Because if it is deemed by the heavens above that we are not to return to our homeland, it will be my honor to die by your side. Because this I promise you, I will die first. In my life, I've heard many, many dramatic speeches before going to battle. Never one like that. The second day of the war, they took over our house. And there are 2-hour shifts on top of the roof. And one of the guys goes up there to start a shift. And 5 minutes later, Yiftach goes to switch him. And he says to him, he goes, it's not 2 hours. Yiftach said, you're married with a kid at home. Go down. I got this shift for you. And as he went down, a rocket hit Yiftach. And he was the first one to go in the Second Lebanon War. 4 years ago, I called up his father. And I said, hi, my name is Eitan Katz. You have no idea who I am. I'm sitting in an office in New Jersey, NCSY. I'm coming to Israel. I was wondering if I can meet with you. He goes, you're going to be in Haifa? I said, sure, I'll drive 3 hours each way, but I'll be in Haifa. I want to learn about your son. He goes, why? I said, my nephew served in his unit. He goes, who's your nephew? I said, Ari Katz. He goes, Ari Katz is my son. I hesitated. I didn't know how to respond. He goes, my son gave his life in his unit, and everyone in his unit has become my family. He goes, they come to my house on a regular basis. They all call me before Shabbat. He goes, I attend all their weddings and all the simchas and all the brises. He goes, and God knows they have a lot of them. He goes, okay. Come to Haifa, we'll schmooze. I show up in Haifa, and he starts talking to me, and tells me story and story and story and story. And I said, what made your son do what he did? He goes, my son loved his grandfather with a tremendous passion. And he stood with his grandfather at the entrance to Auschwitz, and he said, never again. He goes, never again will this happen. And he goes, at that point, he made a commitment to join the Tzanchanim and to be an officer. He says to me something very interesting, which is not really relevant to this topic. He says, he goes, Orthodox Jews are smarter than the rest of us. And I said, that's total nonsense. He goes, no, it's true. I said, no, it's not. He goes, have you ever learned Gemara? So I said, yeah, it's part of the requirements to get smicha. He goes, you Orthodox Jews learn how to take a pasuk, tear it apart, rip it to shreds, put it back together, inside out, because you sharpen your brains, you make things work, you figure things out in a way that no secular Jew can ever figure out. I said, I'm not here to argue with you, but thank you. And I said to him at the end, I said, I speak to a lot of kids every year. I said, what in God's name do you want me to tell them about Yiftach? I said, you tell me stories and stories and stories, because what do you want me to tell them about Yiftach? He said to me like this. He goes, tell them that when they come to Israel, when they go to the Kotel, when they touch the holy, holy stones of the Kotel, they should remember one thing. If it wasn't for those who served and those who continue to serve, those who gave their lives and those who are willing to give their lives, because those holy, holy stones would be the foundations of mosques and churches. He goes, and tell them to honor my son's death. I said, how? He goes, my son gave his life for a dream. The dream of Liyot Am Chofshei Be'artzeinu. He goes, tell them that every moment that they're in Israel, every falafel they buy, every shawarma they buy, every step they take, every view, every mountain that they climb, every time they go swimming the Dead Sea or climb Masada, they should know that it's not for free. They should know the only reason they can do this is because of those who continue to serve. The Friday night that Yiftach died, Ilan Gerbai, his best friend, showed up at his parents' house and said, nothing will change. I will still come here every single Shabbat. I will still hang out with your son and play basketball every Friday night, virtually, because I will still be here with you. A week later, Ilan Gerbai also passed away in Lebanon. I think that one of the most amazing things about the Second Lebanon War is the question that was asked before they went in. The Hesder guys from the Gush Etzion Yeshiva knew that whatever they carried on their back was what they had for the next God knows how long. Food, clothing, water, whatever they carried on their back, that's what they had. And we say, L'rav alechem v'latzam alamayim kim nishmor divrei Hashem, it's beautiful, but in reality, when push comes to shove, do you take your tefillin or 5 cans of tuna fish? Do you take your talis or a few bags of spaghetti? Do you take your sitter or a can of sardines? If someone asked you that shala, I don't know what you would answer. They all called their rabbis and they asked the shala. And the beauty of Hesder today and the Israeli army today is that they asked that shala before going in to the heat of battle. What they ended up doing is 1 in 4. 1 in 4 kids took talis, tefillin, and siddurim, and they shared. And others took food with them. But it's an amazing thing to have an army that functions like that. 11 years ago, when I was 37 years old, married with 4 kids, living in Beit Shemesh, on the Seder night, a suicide bomber walked into a hotel in Netanya and killed over 20 people celebrating the holiday of freedom. The Israeli government knew, and every single person in the country knew, that if we are continuing to be in Am Chofshei Be'artzeinu, when Jews sit down to celebrate the holiday of freedom, Chag HaChirut, there's no way to continue when suicide bombers are on the streets on a weekly basis and a daily basis in that time. We all knew what had to happen. That Friday, we knew there would be an excellent chance that we called up. I spent the day, like most other Jews in the country, on the phone with their friends, going over the halachas of the army. There are about at least a dozen sfarim today on Dinei Tzavah v'Nechama, on all the laws of the army. Happy to give a share any time on the unique, delicate issues of halacha in the Israeli army. And we went through it, and we knew the details, but we went through it in any case to do chazara. Should we go to the base now, before Shabbos? The answer is no. We don't know if we're being called up for sure. We think we are. But we don't know. We may be called up on Shabbos, we may be called up on Sunday. You can't just show up thousands of people at an army base unexpected. You pack our stuff before Shabbos? Definitely. What do you pack? You pack a wallet? Sure, you might need the wallet, even on Shabbos. Do you pack your tefillin? It's Chol HaMoed afterwards. Yeah, the battle looks like it probably is going to last a long time, even though it hasn't even started yet. You pack food, you pack food, you pack everything you need. And that Friday night, made kiddush to my family, had grape juice and not wine, just in case. Went to sleep, and at 1:17 Friday night in the morning, 1:17 a.m., the phone call comes. It's from Anat. Now, the army would deny this, but it happens to be true. The person who calls you up for active duty is usually a very pretty girl, because they want you to have this nice image in your head. And Anat was no exception. She was a very nice, attractive blonde. And she calls up, and I'm in bed, and she goes, Boker Tov, Eitan Manishma, 1:17 in the morning, Shabbos. And I said, Anat, I'm talking to you on Shabbat. I said, Hodu Lashem Kitov. She goes, Motek, I'm not your Motek, my wife's right next to me, please don't cause any trouble. Motek, Tegira Tzeva, Anachnu Yotzim LeMilchama. Come to the army, dear, we're going to war. At that moment, I was actually Mechallel Shabbos. I said, can I say goodbye to my kids first? And she goes, oh, I see you have four children, so come first thing in the morning, we'll wait. I said, where are we going? She goes, Janine. I said, great. Shabbos morning, I would say after a night of no sleep, I took my bag, said goodbye to my four kids, my wife, and started hitchhiking towards the base. Got to the base, an off-air just outside of Givat Ze'ev, for those of you who know the area, and I saw over 1,000 of us there. Religious, non-religious, some people just flew in because the Mondial, the soccer tournament, was going place and taking on in Europe at the time. But as soon as they got the call, they got on the next plane back. And I stood there as Mincha Shabbos afternoon was approaching. And I looked in front of me. I was on top of a hill. And I saw an amazing sight. I saw people with earrings and tattoos, people with no yarmulkes, people with small yarmulkes, people with big yarmulkes, people with black yarmulkes, people with knitted yarmulkes, even a few people with black hats. Yes, even a few people with black hats. And I saw them all preparing for war. And I saw 1,000 Jews who left their wives, children, mothers, girlfriends, significant others, whatever you call it, on a Shabbat morning to go to fight. And I said, and I guess maybe we always had a flair for the drama before the NCSY days, I stood on top of that mountain and I said, what an incredible nation we have of people who leave their wives and children on a Shabbat morning to go to what is 100% guaranteed immediate war. I said, this is an incredible sight. And you have people there with long pass on their cell phones, not for personal phone calls. And people there with black yarmulkes with a pen in hand taking down notes of army codes and radio codes. And then you have the secular Jews smoking and doing whatever else they need to do. And nobody is violating Shabbos. They're all doing the exact details of what is allowed and what is not allowed. No one's doing any one activity more than you have to do on Shabbos to prepare for war, because we know the halachas backwards and forwards, because we spent many years studying them. And over the next couple of days, we headed towards Jenin. It took 2 days of preparation to get ready. And then in small units, not to let the enemy know how many units were actually approaching, we all started gathering in a place called Salem. And Anat sent all of us off. The non-religious soldiers got a hug. The religious soldiers got a handshake. And I remember her looking into my eyes and saying, don't make me call your wife. Don't make her call my wife and tell her I'm not coming home. And as Erev Shvi'i Shel Pesach approached, as we were doing the final preparations for the invasion to Jenin, I stood with my closest friend there and I said, two things we know for sure. One thing is that we're going to be successful. And two is that all of us are going to return home alive. That we know for sure. And the army registrar went from tank to tank, to Nagmash, armored personnel carrying a jeep, making sure that everyone's dog tags matched, making sure pictures of where everyone's sitting in case they had to do a quick DNA testing or anything else they had to do to figure out what body parts belong to which person. and I was late in my preparations, so by the time I got to the truck handing out the bulletproof helmets, they were out of my size. The guy looks at me and goes, "En bayach, yesh chakipah lo shetab seder. You got a yarmulke on your head, you're fine." He's like, "Thanks a lot, and still would like a bulletproof helmet." And my unit was the first unit into Jenin. After the first 48 hours, there were two helicopters shooting nonstop, Vulcan machine guns. Vulcan, like Spock the Vulcan, you can look it up on the internet. Millions of bullets being fired. And after 48 hours, two Arabs were killed. And you can ask yourself the question, how is that possible? How is that possible that in 48 hours of intense fighting, millions of bullets, an insane amount of money, only two Arabs were killed? And the answer is very simple. We, as Jews, have a very different way of fighting a battle. If this shtender is a building, and from that building, there are terrorists shooting at you, but also in that building are innocent civilians, innocent Arab civilians, who are being kept hostage by the Hezbollah. So if we attack the building, we will end up killing innocent civilians. So what the Israeli army does that no other army in the world will do, including the American army, is instead of doing the most efficient thing and just leveling the building, they fire around the perimeter of the building in a big circle, allowing the infantry to approach ever so slowly and only kill those people shooting at you at that moment. Now, just by a quick show of hands, I want to ask you a very simple question. The American army and every other army in the world would level the building. It's war. It's the quickest, most efficient, and safest way of doing business. The Israeli army shoots around the perimeter, allowing the infantry to approach slowly. Just by a show of hands, who thinks the American method is better? So most of you think the Israeli method is better. I want to tell you something. For 11 years, I've wondered about the same question. I don't know the answer. I don't pretend to know the answer. I know that 6 months ago, I took my only son and walked him through the gates of the IDF, knowing that this is our philosophy, and knowing that I don't know the answer. But I also know that in that battle, 13 of my friends lost their lives fighting with that methodology. 13 of the people who stood with me in Salem, going into Jenin, did not return home to their wives and children. Because we fight with a very high ethical level. We say, "Im b'chukatai tishma'u." If you listen to the HaKadosh Baruch Hu, "V'natati geshamim b'itam," the land of Israel gets water when we follow the Torah. I don't know what the Pesach Halacha is. I don't know any Rav who would want to give the Pesach Halacha what to do in this situation. But we pay a very heavy price for our beliefs. After that, we were taken out of Jenin, and we replaced by reinforcements for a few days. We landed the helicopters. We gave security as the helicopters landed. And these young boys, first time in battle, 18 years old, came out of these helicopters, and they were terrified. None of them had ever seen battle before. And they were also hungry because the army did not have enough kosher Pesach food prepared for a war. So they landed, and we all broke out our food to give them. Now, my kids made for me these chocolate rum balls, kosher Pesach, obviously, with black sprinkles on top of them. So I handed them to these like little kids going to battle. We gave them hugs. We wished them luck. We told them it would be okay. We lied. The next morning, we got the papers delivered to us, and I see two of them on the front page. realizing that my kids' chocolate round balls was the last meal that they ate before giving their lives. We see, say, Mika Amcha Yisrael, we have an incredible nation. I want to tell you the truth. Before every battle, the commanding officer does exactly what the Torah tells us to do. He stands in front of the unit and says, whoever does not want to go to war, whoever had a bad dream, whoever has a weird feeling, whoever it's the wrong time for them, just step aside. No bad feelings. It's okay. There'll be another war next year, or the year after, the year after. You're welcome to come back. But if you don't feel today is the right day for you to go to war, you can step aside and that's okay. And there are soldiers who step aside. And there really are no bad feelings. My best friend did it at one time because his wife had a bad dream. His wife had a dream where she pictured herself going to his funeral. And before one of the battles in Gaza, he said, you know what? I just can't do this time. I got to walk aside. And that's fine. But the soldiers who go forth with a tremendous amount of pride. Last year, Sefer Torah was donated to my unit, which is now being kept in Susia and Drom HaChevron. And that Sefer Torah now goes with my unit to battle. I want you to understand one thing, and with this I'll end. 50% of the Israeli officers in combat today are Orthodox Jews. The best units, the best soldiers, come from the Hesde Yeshivas these days. When I asked the Shaila of should I head for the best unit that I can get into, the answer was, there's no question, of course you should, because you represent God and country. When we stood at the Kotel and received simultaneously the gun and the Tanakh, Orthodox Jews fully understand what that means. And as Ilan Gabay said to his best friend, Yiftach Shrier, he's never seen anything quite like this. People who know how to learn Torah to the best levels, and people who know how to fight with the best of them. We have a tremendous amount to be proud of in the Israeli army. May all those who gave their lives be a blessed memory. And when you guys do go to Israel, whether it be for vacation, whether it be for a year, whether it be for more than that, remember, the only reason you get to enjoy the country is because of those who are constantly serving the country to protect you. Thank you.
Amitzeh